My name is Paul Collins from Strang, and I've entitled our little get-together this afternoon, Latin American Religion and Politics, A Separate Reality? Borrow the name, A Separate Reality, from one of Carlos Castaneda's books. You might recognize that. My background in Latin America really stems from a long interest that I've had growing up in South Texas. I've been in Latin America for about two of the last 6 years, most of it in Peru. Part of it as a lay missionary with the Lutheran Church, part of it working with different ecumenical organizations, part of it sort of freelancing on my own and just sort of learning Spanish and traveling around. So I have a rather broad exposure to Latin America, although not really a very specialized one. I chose the title for this lecture because I wanted to key on the words "a separate reality" for a minute, because I believe that to look at Latin America, its religion and politics, that we really have to think about something that is totally, and in one hand, totally different and separate from the experiences that we have in this culture, in this country, of the way religion works and of the way politics works. An example that sort of brings this to mind in kind of a crass way was the conversation I had with an individual a couple of years ago about Latin America, and he kept asking me which state I was in Latin America. And I said, well, I was in Peru, and he said, oh, the state of Peru. And I realized that he had, bringing his North American consciousness to Latin America, was thinking, well, Latin America is one country and there are many states, like Brazil and Peru and Mexico, and then all states in one country. Well, of course, they're not. They're independent countries, although a lot of Latin Americans would like to reunite into one large Latin America. In fact, that's a dream that dates back to the days of the great liberators. But to look at the separateness of it, of course, I think looking at the separateness of it is something that is already religious, and that's why I find looking at another culture and getting in touch with the way religion works, the way everything works, a very deep experience, because I believe something in being religious means that we're inherently open to the other, to the transcendent, to things that are different from us. The same way that we go about getting in touch with another culture, open, being open to things that are different, dropping all our preconceptions for a while, not forgetting our beliefs, but just holding our beliefs in abeyance for a while and saying, well, do they apply to this situation or not? That happens, that works with our beliefs about God, too. We don't have to know everything, but we open ourselves to that other reality to learn. Well, so, first of all, on a very basic level, language and culture are different. Most of Latin America is Spanish-speaking, with the exception of small English-speaking countries around the northern coast of South America and a few in the Caribbean, and with the exception of Brazil, which is Portuguese-speaking. Interestingly enough, there are more Portuguese-speaking Latin Americans than there are Spanish-speaking ones because of the large population of Brazil relative to the rest of Latin America. So the language is one great difference. The language of Spanish is a language that allows you to express just small differences in meaning, I think, much better than in English. There might be 20 ways of saying something in Spanish where there are only one or two ways of saying it in English. And each of those ways can really say something very direct about what one means. Cultural differences, of course. Here we have a sort of a myth of a melting pot in this country. Hopefully it's a mosaic or a tapestry where cultures that have come here from Europe or Latin America or wherever, Africa, are blended together in some way. The cultural differences in just Latin America are striking, especially around some of the religious holidays in different places. I spent Easter and Good Friday in Taxco, Mexico a few years ago and saw them going through the Stations of the Cross and just the tremendous deep felt piety. Good Friday was a religious holiday. It was not just another day off, but something, a religious holiday that really influenced the feeling within the whole country in a way that just doesn't happen here. So cultural differences, you know, are striking. It takes one months and months to become acclimated to that, or begin to become acclimated to that. Politics, that's something else that is really a very different, a very separate reality. I think maybe something that we've all been aware of lately is the election in El Salvador, and our news media has often presented that as a turn toward democracy in El Salvador, right? They finally had their election, and more people voted than were expected, and, you know, we should be happy, perhaps, that there was an election in El Salvador. Well, in a sense, perhaps, but that election was a very different kind of election than most were used to. It was an election where people felt like they had to go vote. In most Latin American countries and in El Salvador, people carry identification cards. If you voted in the Salvadoran election, your identification card was stamped. If you did not vote, it was not stamped. Going around after the election with an unstamped identification card meant that, well, you were suspect of siding with the opposition to the government and really suspect to arrest, torture, or death. So there wasn't any freedom, first of all, of whether one went to the polls or not. You chose not to go to the polls only at a very deep risk to your life and livelihood and to that of your family. Another difference there is that, after the election, they found that perhaps many, many more people voted than could have possibly voted in the time allotted and with the voting equipment allotted. So although it was supposedly a democratic election, there were some real questions there. Another problem with the election was that anyone who was left of center has been systematically excluded from Salvadoran politics for years and years, excluded primarily by political leaders being killed. There's a long litany of anyone, you know, who doesn't go with the far right line of just being systematically murdered in El Salvador. So the election, again, represented a very small spectrum from far right people that the Reagan administration found very difficult to deal with to the government of Duarte that had been supported by Reagan. And no one really to the left of that. So an election, yes, but democratic, that's very questionable. We hear about the land reform in El Salvador that had been going on for several months before this current government seems to have been reversing that completely. Land reform again sounded good. We know maybe something about Mexico's land reform or something about the land reform in Peru. Unfortunately, the land reform in El Salvador was designed by the same people within the United States government who designed the pacification of rural Vietnam. So we have to read land reform in El Salvador as pacification of the countryside, meaning that in fact everybody who was known to be in any opposition to the government was either slaughtered on the spot or rounded up and put into jail, and as well as the as rich landowners being paid for their land, and then peasants who had been known to being supportive of the government are then placed back on that land. That was land reform, not a very democratic sort of reform, but again very different from the picture we might have of it. Economics is also a separate reality for us. I think most of us probably in this room, although it might not be the way most people in this country experience it, but most of us in this room have had the experience of getting a payoff for hard work. You know, we work hard, struggle through college, graduate school, or just work in whatever occupation we have, and we get somewhere. There are payoffs. The vast numbers of Latin Americans have the experience of working very hard and not getting anything. I'm thinking particularly right now of a woman in our little mission congregation in the slum of Lima, Peru, where a couple of LCA missionaries had been working several years, who would get up at 4 in the morning, leave her daughter off with a friend, stand on a bus for 2 hours, get to where she worked, put in an 8-hour day, then get on the bus for 2 hours coming home, and at the end of the day would be approximately $1.50 richer. That woman wasn't lucky, I guess I couldn't say that, but she was, in fact, in a better situation than many people who didn't have any job at all. So that is just a reality, that hard work doesn't pay off for most Latin Americans. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps, no matter how hard you try. You're just stuck there. That kind of reality, that different economic reality, I think, was borne out or showed to us very clearly in the failure of Kennedy's Alliance for Progress in the 60s, where the United States really helped with the fusions of capital that should have stimulated the type of development, and this was a theory at least, that had gone on in the United States, but nothing happened after the money was spent, after the development of dams and hydroelectric plants, mining, everything was carried out. Things were the same. Economics are different. It just doesn't work quite the same way as it does here. Religion, then, is very different. We think of ourselves primarily as a Protestant country, sort of our own... what should we say, pride in being Protestant, because there's a long, important Catholic history in this country, and also a history of discrimination against Catholics. Well, Latin America is, of course, primarily Catholic. Catholic, that is, a Catholicism that is mixed with many elements of popular religiosity, many elements of previous symbol systems from many popular religions. If any of you heard Bill Rice last week, you can think a little bit here about the interplay of new symbols with old symbols and the ways that those meanings are linked together and change when the new symbols come into the culture. Religion, Catholicism in Latin America is facing a process of secularization also, so that you do in many of the cities have an increasingly growing number of people who are not religious, who don't give a rap about Christianity anymore. That's a significant process, but it lags behind the process of secularization in this country by many years, but it's important. Religion, then, in general, especially with the poorer people, with the masses of Latin America, is just a central part of the way they experience life and the way they interpret life. They might not always go to church, but popular piety in homes, figures of the Virgin Mary or figures of different saints are all very important. One difference I see between religion in this country and in Latin America also is the groups that tend to be more progressive or groups that tend to work more toward popular change. In this country, we often get the feeling that the hierarchies of our church are maybe pushing political trips on us and are saying, okay, you all have to take a certain stand on Vietnam, speak out here, or take a certain stand here. And some churches on the grassroots level are saying, hey, wait a second, we don't want to be involved in any kind of these things. That's not always true, but I think that's sort of a stereotype that many of us might have. Well, the opposite reality is really at work in the Latin American church. It is the poor churches, the people at the base level, who are really most involved in working for change, and it's the conservative hierarchies, the bishops, archbishops, in general, with notable exceptions like Brazil, but in general, the hierarchies are very conservative. We could see this, for example, in preparation for the Second Council of Latin American Bishops, which was held in Puebla in early 1979, where before that, for many years, López Trujillo, a bishop, a priest who'd been working out of Colombia, had been the center person for a new strategy by the bishops to stop the progressive change within the Catholic Church. It had been a strategy that had gone on since 1968, saying, hey, the Catholic Church has to become more conservative again, get back to just the type of religion we always had. The conservative hierarchies, bishops will often function in terms of denouncing priests who might be involved in popular struggles or in politics. Again, I think often that is not the case now, though, too, so I see hope there that is changing. Countries like Nicaragua, where one had a very conservative hierarchy also, which in the end gave its full support, although critical support, to the revolutionary process within Nicaragua. So, hoping we're dropping some of our stereotypes for a minute and being open to hearing about a separate reality, something that is different. But then there's the other side, and that's why I had the question mark in the title, A Separate Reality Question Mark, because it's not so separate. Things in Latin America are very closely linked to what happens in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly linked to what happens in this country. I think one of the best ways that economists and sociologists have described this type of process in recent years is with the twin terms of development and underdevelopment. Thinking not in terms of, okay, every country starts underdeveloped and develops, but looking at development and underdevelopment as two parallel processes. So while we have the Northern Hemisphere developing itself economically, we have the Southern Hemisphere and Latin America particularly being underdeveloped as an active process, moving from a certain stage of development to less development. You can see this sort of process already in the arrival of the Spanish conquistadores, where the conquistadores in fact confront some pretty highly civilized peoples. The Incas of Peru, who have walls that have designed earthquake-proof buildings that have withstood 7, 8, 9 earthquakes that reach 10 on the Richter scale. The walls are still standing. Advanced people, only an advanced people could put that together. We're still waiting in San Francisco to see whether in fact our own architects are as advanced as the Incan architecture was. The Mayas, the Aztecs, they were great civilizations in Latin America. Suddenly most of that is wiped out with the arrival of the Spanish. Until about 100 years ago, almost all Latin American countries were completely self-supporting, self-sufficient in terms of food, growing their own corn, whatever that the people needed to survive. Now you run into almost no countries, with probably the exception of Argentina, that are self-sufficient in food. Again, underdevelopment. The food production for the needs of the people has been underdeveloped, wiped out. It's a parallel process. It goes hand in hand with the needs of the first world. We have a lot of wheat in this country that needs to be exported. The Latin American countries that used to survive on corn now survive on boatloads of wheat. And in fact, then our selling food from this country becomes a very easy way of manipulating politics within Latin American countries. You can see, of course, I think this same process around just the structures of a country like Argentina, which has a large British community going back for a long time. The British originally developed the railroads in Argentina. The railroads not serving the transportation needs of the people at all in Argentina, but the railroads all going to the center of Buenos Aires, the center where all the natural products can be taken to port and gotten out of the country. You can see that all over. You can't, you know, if the railroads stem out from the city, you can't get from here to here. You know, you have to go into the city and then back out. Terribly difficult transportation, but very good for the country that is on the receiving end of these many natural products. Another way that...
Did you say that was in Argentina?
Yeah. But that is also the case in, I don't know specifically in other countries, certainly in Peru, again, transportation is like that. Sort of a wagon wheel effect going into the mountains in different places to bring natural resources to the capital city of Lima and then get them out. And, you know, communication, transportation in the back country is next to impossible, even now very, very difficult. In the United States, it's important to remember, I think, the Monroe Doctrine and what that says about our special relationship with Latin America, a relationship that means, well, Latin America is ours, our back porch in one sense or another. It's interesting that we have sort of allowed Great Britain to do what it has wanted to in Argentina and backed it up in spite of the people in government who would still like to see the Monroe Doctrine functioning. We can really see, again, with the United States particularly, or with perhaps U.S. corporations particularly, the way that Latin America is not separate from us at all. Think about tin in Bolivia. Tin is the mainstay of the Bolivian economy. And Bolivia was really centered around the tin mines for years. What happens when the United States says, well, we've been holding a strategic tin reserve for a lot of years now, and we really don't need this tin anymore. We don't think that it's going to be that valuable a resource, so why don't we sell that tin? But we can choose to sell that tin at a time when it would, at any time, but any time we sell that tin, and it has been being sold now, with that tin sale by this country virtually wipes out the Bolivian economy when that happens, because our strategic stockpile is much larger than the total output of the Bolivian economy every year. So that's one way, again, that that Bolivia really has no economic freedom. It can't make its own choices without running the risk of having some very disastrous consequences if in fact the United States or any other country that happens to own a lot of resources that a particular country would want to sell decides to play around with the market in one way or another. You've seen this also in Jamaica, where after Michael Manley and his socialist government nationalized bauxite holdings and aluminum production years ago, you suddenly saw that we were a lot more careful about where we bought our aluminum in this country. You can also see it with the tourist industry. I don't know if many people in here have been thinking about traveling to the Caribbean in the last few years, but I was sort of watching the Jamaican situation, and before the election last year in Jamaica, where Michael Manley was defeated by a right-winger, Edward Sayaga, who had the strong backing of the Reagan administration, was one of the first foreign heads of state to meet with Reagan, actually. Why, you saw in different tourist agencies that there was no advertisement about Jamaica, and talked to people who had asked, well, what about going to Jamaica? And usually what they heard from tourist agents was, well, we've heard that there's a lot of violence in Jamaica, and there was a lot of violence, but people were discouraged from going. Suddenly, after Edward Sayaga was elected, I happened to, you know, just walking down the street and looking at travel agencies, see big travel posters for Jamaica again. State Department, whoever, however this happens within the tourism business, has said, okay, it's all right to go to Jamaica again, even though there's still political violence in Jamaica. A separate place, a separate reality, but very much linked to what happens here. Another example of the way a particular corporation might be able to do that was Chile. After the election of Salvador Allende in 1970, the executives of AT&T said, well, there will be no more phones fixed in this country until Salvador Allende is no longer in office. Kind of a harsh, unbelievable thing. It's all in the Senate Foreign Relations and House Foreign Affairs Committee's testimony about U.S. intervention in Chilean politics. So it's all there in the documentation about the way AT&T executives said this. And well, in fact, no phones were fixed in Chile until Salvador Allende was overthrown on September 11th, 1973. A tremendous control over the country. You know, what happens when the phones start breaking down and government officials try to talk to each other, and, you know, who can fix the phones? Who has the technology? Difficult question. Religion also in Latin America has been very much formed by the First World, formed originally by the conquistadores who brought Catholicism, sort of as the other side of colonialization. You Christianize everyone at the same time that you take over the country. In many cases, I think it was a sort of a misuse of Spanish missionaries by the colonial empire, the Spanish colonial empire. You had a lot of well-meaning people, well-meaning priests. In fact, I think there are probably very many well-meaning conquistadors who really were working for the salvation of the Indians. Whatever the intention of the Spanish missionaries, the process was usually, again, domination, oppression, holding people down, replacing religious beliefs by beliefs imported from the outside. It's interesting, there's a small rural town about 2 hours out of La Paz, Bolivia, where there is a Catholic church in the center of what used to be a couple of civilizations. They're small ones. I can't remember their names right now. But to get people into that church, they had brought a number of religious statues that the people had been worshiping for many years and placed them at the entrance of the church so people would feel like, in fact, they were still paying homage to their old gods when they were being forced to accept the new gods. And there are various stories of religious icons that were hidden behind altars, for instance, by the people who were forced to pray to Jesus Christ and look at the crucifix on the wall, whatever. They knew they had to do that, but they put their different religious symbols within the altar or behind it, and in fact could then have some sort of integrity in their own religious lives as they were forced to accept another religion. Protestantism then from England, Germany, and then primarily from the United States went hand in hand with this new First World movement into Latin America. So you have North American capital, North American entrepreneurs going to Latin America at the same time as Protestant missionaries are going there. Hand in hand, bring North American culture in. It's a process, again, where, you know, unfortunately, many very well-meaning, devout Christians, missionaries, laity, have been, in fact, used by a larger sort of process of political and economic domination. Sometimes, unfortunately, missionaries are not unaware of those processes, but are in fact very much see themselves as a part of a new form of domination. You can see that in the way religious struggles also have borne out the struggles between different empires in Latin America, between different first world empires coming into Latin America. That gives you a little bit of overview then about how things are separate and yet very much influenced by the First World. I'd like to maybe give a few minutes for a couple of questions and then move on to some specific issues that I think are often raised by North Americans or people coming from a North American consciousness. A few questions?
As a missionary in Peru, did you feel the same kinds of things that you were just saying about the Protestant missionaries? And if so, what kind of things did you do to counteract that, or weren't you able to?
I think a lot of mission programs now are trying to build a counteraction to that into their programs, the whole concepts of reversing the flow of mission, of getting missionaries to come to the United States or getting people like me to go to Latin America to be there for a while, but really then come back in mission to the United States, so that part of my mission hopefully would be in this country where I'm sharing the realities of Latin America that I experienced back with people in this country. A way of counteracting that process on the local level is to say, okay, I'm going to do virtually nothing unless the people have told me that it's what they want and that it meets their needs. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, local groups in Latin America are often in control of what a foreign missionary may do, and they run the show. So that's one major way that that is counteracted there.
This problem we have in San Salvador now. We have the government saying one thing, we have the Catholic missionaries and the church saying another thing. Elaborate a little more on that.
I will do that shortly in the process. I think since we don't have a lot of time, why don't
I speak about the tourist industry? I've often wondered why Brazil and South America doesn't advertise like for tourists from the owner very much.
Well, I've seen quite a bit of advertisement. That would counteract my experience, because I usually, at least in, say, the Washington, D.C. area or San Francisco area, see an incredible amount of
Out here you see a lot toward China, Hawaii, Europe and so forth, but you seldom see the special ads to South America.
Mm-hmm.
And we wondered about that.
That's
supposed to be a really pretty country too.
Braniff used to do a lot of ads for South America. Mm-hmm. If they happened to write.
Yeah.
Are you going to comment on Falkland Islands and the justice issue there?
In part, not too deeply.
I have one question about the Catholic Church in reference to this statement that was made or comment that was made this morning. What is the Catholic Church from Rome doing to support any non-conservative, or are they flat taking?
I hope to touch that also.
Right.
Well, many Catholics in the South, are they dependent on the Catholic Church a lot?